Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. Thanks a lot for all of your emails and messages and posts on goodreads.com. I do reply to every email that I get and it's really great to have some fun conversations backwards and forwards by email. You can email me luke@juggler.net and also on the discussion forum. And messages and comments on books, which you can find over at goodreads.com. Check out the SFBRP listener group there for discussion with other SFBRP listeners and things like that. So, let's just get straight on to today's episode and the book that I'm going to be reviewing. I listened to as an audiobook. It's by Hannu Rajanaimi. I can't remember his exact name, but he's a Finnish author, and he wrote a book called The Quantum Thief, which was published in 2010, and the audiobook comes to about 10 hours long, and I've got the Goodreads.com page open for it here, and it's 336 pages in the original hardback, so not a very big book, a pretty decent length book. I actually quite like books of that length, they're pretty easy to get through normally. And the reason I read this is because it's been... actually, when it first came out, there's quite a bit of buzz about it, and I looked at it and I thought, oh, it looks kind of interesting, maybe I'll check it out someday. And then some other reviews came through and it seems a bit mixed reviewed, but lots of people have been recommending it to me, and someone emailed me recently and said, hey, you should check it out, and then somebody else emailed me and said, hey, you should check it out, and then when I asked for episode ideas for episode number 200, which is coming up soon, of the SFBRP, Timo, a friend from Finland, said, hey, you should read this book, and I was like, well, is it, like, why should I review that for book 200? Why should I review that for episode 200 and not another book anyway? But Timo is, like I say, Finnish, and Hannu Rajanaimi is Finnish as well, so I guess he's trying to get the home team of Finnish science fiction read. I presume this has been written in English, even though it's written by someone who is Finnish, because I haven't seen any translation or anything like that, so I'm guessing it's just a first published in English, or originally published in English. And So let's get straight onto it. So the setting of this, it's in quite distant future. It's never actually explained how far in the future it is, but it's enough time that humans have gone to Mars and started terraforming Mars, and then, you know, I'm thinking maybe 1,000 years in the future. I'm really not sure, because the setting is very, 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 very technologically advanced, kind of like a post-singularity kind of level of technology that, if you can imagine it, technology-wise, it could probably exist in this book, indistinguishable from magic, all of that kind of stuff. But it seems to be based in reality, even though the book starts out in this in a prison, and the prison is it's called the Dilemma Prison, I think, and so it starts out, and I guess it's sort of like where people's minds are uploaded into for them to serve time in prison, and it's the Dilemma Prison because there's a, you know, the thought experiment, or the experiment, the prisoner's dilemma, and this really appealed to me right off the bat because I understood what was going on. I actually wrote a story of myself where somebody keeps living through thought experiments, and he goes, okay, this is this thought experiment, so now you're inside a thought experiment, and then you wake up and then you go back into another thought experiment. So it felt felt quite familiar to me in that way, and there's some good writing at the beginning. This thief who's in there, the quantum thief of the title, we meet him straight away. His name is called Jean Le Flambeur, and he is broken out of the Dilemma Prison and taken into the real world. And in the real world is stuff which is, you know, very computer gamey. I know it's a weird thing to say that, but there's ships flying around. It's the space opera kind of thing. But there's like, for example, the person who breaks him out is called Maylie, and she's got a ship which has got a mind of its own, a bit like the culture. That's called Pahonan. The ship is called Pahonan, and they get attacked straight away, and Maylie turns on her combat autism, and straight away we're thrown into this, like, really advanced technology, really strange technology that we've not seen some of it, and you're not quite sure if it's a constructed reality, or if you're taken out of the prison, or what was in the prison. Was he in the prison, or was his mind in the prison? Again, none of these questions are answered immediately, but then straight away, taken to Mars. And most of the action takes place on Mars, on a moving city on Mars called the Oubliette. And Mars has been terraformed, or the Oubliette is part of the terraforming force on Mars. And but it's the kind of the terraforming has been stalled a bit, even though this big moving city, which immediately when they're talking about moving city, reminded me of a movie that I saw recently, the John Carter movie, and there's a big moving city there, which is walking along, and you get these big legs underneath it walking along, and there's a kind of terraform, well, not a terraform Mars, it's trying to keep Mars breathable and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I kind of had that kind of image in my head. Although this city that they're in, called the Oubliette, is constantly rearranging itself. So there's streets that are there. There's called the permanent way or the permanent avenue. I can't remember exactly. So that's always there. But as you go further and further away from this, the city is constantly, because each city block kind of moves on its own legs or moves at its own speed. They're constantly rearranging themselves, which is, it's quite interesting because, you know, people go, well, where am I? Where's the map? Well, there is no map. You're a visitor. Well, stick onto the permanent way. Otherwise you'll get lost. Everyone gets lost. You need to be able to recognize buildings and find them way around. So things can get lost in this city and pop up again and then lost again and popped up again. Anyway, it's part of the terraforming thing. Again, I can't really explain it too well, but it's like the terraforming has been stalled because of constant attacks by the Phobos or the Phobans, Phobuses, and these, I'm again not really that well explained, but there's some kind of force which is like a self-replicating machine which is then fighting against the terraforming, and no matter what they keep doing, they're terraforming, these phobi keep coming down, the phobi keep coming down and trying to undo the work. So there's this constant war going on, but the people inside the Oubliette are pretty safe because there's forces outside the Oubliette trying to like protect them and things like that. So, like I say, most of the action in the book takes place there, and this seems to be one of the last kind of areas where baseline humans live, but you're never really quite sure if someone is baseline human or not. And by baseline human, I mean, well, everybody else has accelerated, everyone else is transhuman, extra human, more than human, augmented this, augmented that, augmented bodies, this person's got wings, this person's got an extra brain, this person has got, there's thousands of this person because he's replicated himself throughout other people here. And the Oubliette seems to be trying to preserve humans for the long haul. And at the same time I was reading this book, or listening to this audiobook, Juliana, my girlfriend, was reading The City and the Stars by Arthur C. Clarke. And this, it was quite strange that we're both reading this, because that has also got a weird kind of setup, a city which constantly rebuilds itself and moves itself around, of course, over a longer period of time. You know, and everyone stays on the city and doesn't go outside of the city. It was one of those weird things that when you read that book, you presume that everybody comes out and is human and everyone's totally human. And then when Juliana was reading it, she was like, yeah, but he says that they don't have any teeth. They don't have individual teeth and they don't have any fingernails and they don't have this or that. And that reminded me of my review of that book for the SFBRP, where I was talking like the humans in that book are almost indistinguishable from robots. And because they kind of go in and they, like, at the end of their life, they go and they put their memories back inside, and then they wait thousands of years, and then their memories come out again, and they grow up, and they don't know who their parents are, and then they discover who their parents are, and all these different kind of things. So they're constantly going in and sleeping, and then coming out and living and being in a new city among new people again, and then going to sleep and coming out again. But if that's what happens to you, if your memories are on file and your body is completely reconstructed, where is the line between being a natural human and a constructed human, or being just a robot, or a robot who thinks they're a human? Anyway, it's a bit strange. That's not where the similarities between The City and the Stars stops, though, of course, with them here in the Oubliette, in the Quantum Thief. You also live for a certain amount of time, and then at the end of your time, you're put back to sleep again, and you have to then work. You become one of the Quiet, and the Quiet are one of like the robot servants or computer servants. You just get given work to do, and you're controlled by the voice, and you take part in the great quest or the great task. I think it's the great task, and the great task is, hey, we've got to terraform Mars. And so there's only so much space on the city, because outside of the city is too dangerous, and off of Mars there isn't any real humanity left. So again, it's this little, like I say, this little hideout of humans, or the last bastion of true humanity, but again, it brings up more questions than are actually answered in this book about, you know, what is real human and what are the people doing there. Of course, there are some revelations later on in the book about that kind of stuff, but like I say, it brought up the similar kind of questions that The City and the Stars did. And also one of the other big parts of this, the oubliette and the people who live there, there's ultimate non-privacy, which, and from ultimate non-privacy comes the ultimate illusion of privacy. Because everything is mediated through like a digital interface with public and private key pairs controlling who gets access to what you see and what you hear and what you touch and what you taste and what you feel and also what you remember. So you can have a conversation with someone and you have what's called a gevulot, which, again, not very well explained, except that is kind of like the interface that you control to decide who sees you. It's like, you know, like the ultimate Facebook settings, like who can see this post, who can see that post. Well, at this time, only my friends can see it, and now only my friends and friends can see it, and now this is private, and only if I share it with one person, or this is all public, you know. And there's parts of the oubliette, which is in the Agora, which is like the forum, and everyone can go down there, and everything there is public, and everyone can see what everyone does, and that's fine. But then when you go off into different parts, some things, you know, can be very private, but it gets to the point where two people can be living in the same house, but you don't know that there's somebody living with you, and you can't hear them, you can't see them, they're just like a shadow that goes past, just to like, kind of say, don't walk into this place, otherwise you'll bump into them. And like I say, there's memories as well, so you can have a conversation with someone, and it gets stored in exo memory. But if you have an interaction with someone, like a conversation or even like a one-night stand or anything like that, you can then say, I withdraw permission for them to remember anything about me. So they won't even remember a part of a conversation or any bit of a conversation with you. So you can control memories. But on the flip side of that, if you do something with somebody else, if you do something by yourself, like if you read something and you want somebody else to read the same thing, you don't have to send them it to read. You can just send them like the key, access key to that memory of yours. So they immediately remember having read something at the same time. So you have it like a memory sharing or a co-memory that goes through the exo memory. So, of course, like I say, this sounds great. Ah, everything's private. But of course, the only way that this can work is that everything is actually... I wouldn't say everything is non-private, but everything is being observed all the time, including your own memories are being observed all the time. And it's just the question of that you have the key to your memories and nobody else has the key to your memories. Or do they? Well, that's the thing. I'll bring that up in a second. So, what I was going to say about this. Yeah, so of course, there are points where, you know, you get the digital hole where someone comes along with an analog camera and they take a photo and they're like, wait, you can't take a photo of me. That means you can then look at that later and I don't have control over it. So it seemed a bit strange that everything had this, was like going through this digital interface, but then there was analog holes. And there are different parts of the city where you can meet up with people and you don't immediately know who they are. And they don't, the default is that they can see everything rather than the default seeing nothing. And again, we're not going to get too much more into that now, but it does play a huge part throughout it. Like I said before as well, once you run out of time, you have to die, and time then becomes a currency. And it reminded me of a film called, I think, In Time, which was a recent one. I think Justin Timberlake was the star of that, and it was directed, I can't remember who it was directed by, but the same guy who directed Gattaca. And then there's this movie, and it's not a great movie. It's the first half of it's really good, because it's a good exploration of what if time was currency, and if you run out of time, you had to die. And this has a similar kind of thing, but of course in that movie, once you died, that's it, it's permanent. Whereas in this book, in The Quantum Thief, on the oubliette, once you die, there is going to be a form of reincarnation later on. Some other things that come up. There's some other really cool tech. There's these statues and these people. These statues are very slow moving people because they're actually robots that look like statues, but their minds, the minds of these statues are, you know, quiet people. The people who have been they're in the quiet, but I think they're meant to be prisoners or they're soldiers from some time. Again, it's not really quite sure, and you're never quite sure what's reality in this book, or if it's just a legend, or if it's real history, or if it's history hidden by time. But there's a really cool idea that lots of these statues around the city are actually having, or across the Agora, are having a battle, but the battle is happening in such slow motion that the humans living there, they never actually see more than, you know, a few seconds of the battle in their entire lifestyle. Some really cool stuff in the book like that. And also you get another sort of faction here in the Oubliette, or sort of operating outside the Oubliette or the edges of the Oubliette, not quite sure, are the Gogol Pirates, and they want the keys to people's memories. And then they can sell those memories off-world, off of Mars. And if someone's got a unique memory, for example, at the beginning we read about this chocolatier who makes chocolate, and he's got perfect chocolate-tasting skills. And off-world, this could actually be a real novelty, so the Gogol Pirates could be able to take this developed sense over the whole lifetime of this person and sell it off-world. So, yes, getting keys to people's memories is entirely illegal, because then you can sell them to people and things. But yeah, that sort of plays in to the story as well. So let's move on to some of the characters and then a bit of the story, the main story. Of course, you've got Jean Le Flambeur. He's a master thief. And the Wikipedia page actually said he was based on the Arsène Lupin character, which I've never actually read, but, you know, I know it a bit. And I did realize when I was looking up some of the other names, I don't have internet access at the moment, but I looked it up, but I realized one of the other person's name in this book is actually an anagram of Arsène Lupin, which is probably well known, but I listened to this as an audiobook, so it was only when I looked on the Wikipedia page at the list of characters where I was like, wait, okay. Maybe it was mentioned there, but I think I worked that out by myself. It was a few days ago that I actually looked it up. So, he's a thief. He's a gentleman thief. Sometimes he it seems like in his past he's well known throughout most of the galaxy. He's famous in that way. But I wish I could say more about him, but I didn't really find out much more about him, because at the beginning of the book he gets busted out of a prison by Mila, who is this winged warrior in her ship, and her ship's called Pohonan, Mila serves a goddess, and the goddess wants something stealing, and Jean Le Flambeur is busted out of prison. He's like, yep, okay, I'll steal this thing. He says, but before I can do that, I need to, before I got caught, I hid away my memories. So while I've been in prison, I don't actually remember all of the stuff. So what I need to do is actually go to Mars, and because he's out, the prison is out in the Oort cloud or out past Neptune or something. And he goes, yeah, but I need to actually get my memories back. So the main character, our first person narrator, the first person character that we read for a lot of the book, about a third of the book is told from his point of view. He doesn't really know who he is himself, which I thought it was really difficult to connect with him. Whereas other characters who did seem to know more about themselves, did know it. So he'd hidden the keys to his own memories, his own exo memories, from himself. So yeah. What is this other character? Yeah, Pohonan is a ship with a personality, like I said before. That's the note that I have here. And it felt like a bit culture-like, but the personality of the ship seems very, very good at running the ship and very, very good at shooting stuff, but seems to be innocent in many ways. Like, it's like, oh, damn it, that human tricked me. And in a culture ship, like by Ian M. Banks, you'd never think, oh, no human would be able to trick a ship, not like a battleship. Sometimes it happens, of course, but you always think it's like minor ships, like, you know, personnel transporters might be able to get tricked by a human, but not a lot else. So yes, he gets broken at steel, and he has to go thing to go there. So for a long time, I thought he was, you know, because Mila said, okay, the goddess wants something stealing, let's go and steal it. And he's like, wait, I need to get my memories back. And because it took me quite a long time to listen through this book, which the reasons for that I'll get on in a bit. But every time I was thinking, it's like, oh, what's he stealing again? I was like, oh no, does he know what he's stealing? I can't remember. Is he stealing something now? Is he still just trying to get his memories back? Oh, he's looking for his memories. And then I kept on waiting to find out what he had to steal. And then I realized, as I was getting to like the last quarter of the book, I'm like, he's not going to steal it in this book. He hasn't got his memories yet. He hasn't got his memories back yet. So I realized that's book two. It's a trilogy, but I thought I was getting more. I mean, this is a self-contained story, but the thing that he goes about is like, right, let's go steal something. Okay, but wait, I've got to get my memories. Okay. And I thought him getting his memories was going to be like a part of the story. It turns out to be that's the main thrust of his story all the way through. And I found that kind of disappointing, because now I know that to know what he has to steal, but I'm not even slightly interested in what he has to steal, because there's nothing in this book which makes me curious about the thing that he has to steal. So, but he did get some of his memories back, and he did understand what was going on. And I guess they were important to him, I guess. I didn't find them that interesting. Meanwhile, there's a guy called Isidore, and let me just open the wiki page again here so I can find his his name is Isidore Beautrelet, and he is about 20 years old, or 10 Martian years old, and as it says here on the Wikipedia page, and he is a detective. The game that he likes playing is detective, and he has this a mentor who's this mysterious character called the Gentleman, and the Gentleman says, "Hey, what you need to do is go check out this," and he's like, "Okay," and you know he gets to the bottom of things as well. And so what happens is that someone gets in contact with him and says, "Hey, could you help me out with this thing?" And things come together, and it turns out he has to then confront Jean-Luc Lambert over different stuff, and again. So all the time, it's like this cat and mouse between Isidore and Jean-Luc Lambert. And meanwhile, Isidore has got a girlfriend who's a member whose name is Pilou or something. And she's part of the Zoku. And the Zoku is kind of a zingy bong and a dingy dang and other proper noun and other noun. Powerful group of non-Mars people who help out technologically and things like that. So they end up tracking each other. And Jean-Luc Lambert sometimes wants to help out in some ways, but then he needs help from a Golgol pirates. And the Golgol pirates are illegal, but he doesn't really want to intentionally get on the bad side of the authorities. And then later on, there's like this twist and a revelation about the city and, you know, what the history of the city is. And there's a bit of things going there. Unfortunately, quite a bit of the story at the end, it seems to be that we follow people finding out that other people have found out about stuff before then, and then they're just learning what other people have found out. And these other people have found out the hard way and have kind of collected together all the information and then going, "Hey, check it out." And we read about people reading about things that people have found out the hard way. And I always wonder, why don't we follow the people who find out the hard way? Why do we have to follow these about who are just told about it later on? Which again, slightly disappointing. In the end, I actually thought the whole story was pretty simple, despite me thinking that it was going to be a lot more tricky. It turns out to be, you know, there's like a bit of like conspiracy stuff in there, a bit of heisty kind of stuff in there, a little bit of action at the end. And some, you know, good kind of science fiction battles, like the, you know, sort of like hyper speed, like the people slowing down time to be able to fight against each other, like one molecule at a time. I really enjoy that kind of stuff. But the story itself, I was expecting it to be, a little bit more complex, let me put it that way. But maybe it is more complex, but I didn't get the complexity because I'll have to read book two to be able to see what was going on in this. Again, pretty tricky to understand what's going on at some points. And there were some twists in the story, but they didn't feel like twists to me. They would have been twists for the people in the story, because they, you know, there must have been earth-shaking twists for a lot of these people, or Mars-shaking twists, because it's on Mars. But I was looking at it from the outside, and I didn't really have enough, because it's quite a short novel, I didn't really have enough time to be absorbed in the world to be shocked or upset when I found out that something that I thought was real wasn't real. And the people that I'd spending time with, like the characters, I didn't spend enough time with them to care about them. So when they discovered something important about themselves, I was just like, "Oh, right, okay," you know. It's like at the beginning, if it was at the beginning of Star Wars and Darth Vader turns up in like scene number three, says, "Luke, I am your father." You're like, "Okay, okay, that's his father." Well, that was, you know, mildly unexpected, but not really a shock. But then when you get to, the end of the second movie, and it's like, "Luke, I am your father." It's like, "No, wait, no." And it's a big twist for everyone because you spent enough time with them, because it's such a short book and you never really spend enough time with any of the characters. You know, when somebody learns the truth about themselves, because like I say, there's memories hidden away from people. So when they actually unlock their own memories, they're like, "Oh," and I'm like, "Really? Oh, I didn't know that was going to be important." Maybe in 1,000 years in the future, those kind of things are still important to people, or maybe other things are important, but we never really understood what was important to the people in the book. We never saw them, you know, we didn't see people grow up and develop those memories, then lose them and then get them back. Or I know it's, you know, of course, then it wouldn't be a twist for us either, but I was never meant to know what should concern me about the characters. Which brings me on to... I'll go to the writing style and talk about a bit of the themes. I've got some notes here, and they're kind of bit spread out, some of these notes, but I'll see if I can wrap it up together. So, since I finished this book on Tuesday, on a flight to Dublin, and I'm now on a cruise ship sailing up to Iceland. I'm actually quite far north. It's almost midnight and it's still light outside because I'm so far north at the moment. Anyway, so I'm on a cruise at the moment. I'm working on a cruise ship, and so I finished this book, The Quantum Thief, on the way up. But before I reviewed this, I thought, well, I've got this other audio book that I want to read, and it's not a science fiction book or a fantasy book. It's a book by Stephen King, so it's a little bit horror kind of thriller kind of thing going on. It's called Joyland. It's his latest novel. I saw it there on Audible and was like, yep, might as well get it. Short Stephen King book, and I heard it had a good ending as well, rather than some of his weaker endings in some of his other novels. So I checked it out. And Joyland is about, again, I'm not going to do a full review, but I just want to mention it. That it's about, you know, someone going and working on a an amusement park called Joyland when he's 21. His name is Devin, and Devin Jones. And yeah, so this book is full of descriptions of being at an amusement park, and it's descriptions of people who work there and people who visit there, and the relationships between the people who work there and the people who visit there, and the people who work there and the people who work there, and the people who work there and the people who live nearby. And, you know, there's lots about what it's like to be, you know, 21 years old, and what it's like to be a virgin, and what it's like to break up with your girlfriend and things. And it's really well written. And also there's a bit of a detective story in there. Unfortunately, quite a bit of the detective story is somebody else going to, you know, to do the hard work, and then they come back and say, and here's what I found out, which is a bit of a pity. But that's not what the book's about. You know, the book is about the descriptions and spending a lot of time with people. And the way that it's written, I really felt like I was there. They're talking about, because it's an amusement park, it's about the carnies, and that there's this thing called the talk. And the talk is all of the jargon, all of the slang, all of the phrases that the people who work there use to create kind of an in-group at this amusement park at Joyland. You know, they say the peoples aren't rubes, they're conies, and stuff is spiked and stacked and tooled, and other things are highs, and other things are whizzes, and some of them are things and dangs and dibbly bings and bibbly bongs, because I'm just making up words now. But because he says, and this is what this means, and then, oh, it's a coney. No, it's a rube. No, it's a coney. We're not allowed to call them rubes, we're going to call them conies, but conies are like rabbi. And like every new word is sparked, you know, every new bit of the talk, every new bit of lingo is described, and it says, and this is this, and this is what this is, and this is what this is, and people have conversations about it, and people say, oh, you're not allowed to use that word, you should use this word, like, what does wearing the fur mean, and wearing the fur is this, and wearing the fur, what is wearing the fur, people keep talking about wearing the fur, what is wearing the fur, and then you find out what's wearing the fur, you've got this long description of what it's like wearing the fur, and then you get all these different words, and there's this new lingo, and everything feels very lived in. It feels very real. And again, it's just, you know, part of the jargon's this. But, and I was thinking, well, does he really need to spend so long to talk about what it's like to be dumped by your girlfriend? Because I guess most people who read the book have been dumped at some point. Someone has split up with them, and someone's moved on and got into another relationship really quickly. And it's, you know, and it's not a surprise when it comes in the book, because you can see it coming. It's like, oh yeah, and this was it. This happens about this time, and this is going to be the story about this happening. And when he, you know, he describes a day, it's like, and this day was amazing. There's no way I could describe what it was like. You know, I'm not good enough at writing about this because, you know, the frame story is he's a journalist later, but he writes for trade magazines, you know, is the author. So he's not a novelist, he's like a trade. So this is the kind of thing. I would never be able to describe this day. I'd never be able to do it justice. And after saying that, then he goes about and describes the whole day in minute detail. And then we went this, and then we went on that ride, and then the boy came over here, and then we went on this ride, and it was amazing. And then we went here, and I was getting tired, and then we had some food over here. And you just thought, you said you couldn't describe it. And then he does go on to describe it and does bring that lived in stuff. So then at some point, of course, people die in the book, and because they die, you really understand their connection to the world and what it means. And it, even though the book did feel slow, I mean, it wasn't a long book, but sometimes it felt a bit slow. It's like, well, how long is it going to spend, you know, how long are they going to spend, you know, saying, you know, talking about this or talking about that, you know. I say, yeah, Joyland is seven and a half hours, and it's spread, like, the action and the book is spread over, like, the course of maybe 4 months or 5 months or 6 months or however long it is, you know, over the course of a summer and an autumn. But I felt like that book, even though it was shorter, it felt a lot more lived in. I felt like I'd spent more time with the characters, even though time had been compressed more, because The Quantum Thief, everything happens in just like a week or so, or, you know, just over the course of a few days. And in Joyland, we're exposed to this new world, and there's all this new lingo, and there's all this new setting, and these new characters that you don't know, but everything is brought close to us. So when stuff happens, it really feels like we're there. And again, like The Quantum Thief, the reason I'm talking about Joyland that way is The Quantum Thief is written in the exact opposite way. There is no explanation of anything. There is no info dumping. Nobody ever has a conversation. Well, the conversations between people is like, well, this is called a gavulot. Well, what's a gavulot? Well, a gavulot is this, and it helps you do this, and there's this setting here, and this setting there is there. Pretty much every single thing comes up entirely out of context. Like, well, not entirely out of context. It's in context. It's being used in context, but we don't know what that context is often. It's just, Gogol pirates are doing this. They tried to steal this, and here's the Agorin, here's the gavulot, and here's the time, and here's the exo memory, and here's the thingy, and here's the bingly bong, and here's the dingly wangly ding. And unlike the amusement park Joyland lingo, all of this, you just have to work it out. And it was so strange reading Joyland afterwards, because the whole point of the lingo in Joyland, you know, among the people who work at the amusement park, is to exclude the Coneys, it's to exclude the Rubes, it's to exclude the people who don't live there, but make a family out of the people who do live and work there. And it felt like The Quantum Thief was written in a way, like I was listening to conversations with lots of jargon and in-talk between people who were doing their own job and I didn't understand. And it felt like I was being intentionally excluded. And which, again, I don't mind, like, working stuff out in a book and it being a quiz, but it did get in the way of me liking the characters. It did get in the way of me in, like, enjoying the characters, and when something happened to the characters, I never felt like I could care about them, because I'd spent, like, all this time, 10 hours with some of these characters, and I still didn't know anything about them. Again, part of that's intentional, part of it's because their memories are hidden from themselves, but part of it just seems like we're rushing through the writing too much, just way too much. And then sometimes, you know, stuff is later in the book explained a bit more, you know, if a character needs to use something for something, it's like, blah, 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 blah. So it's just constantly, you know, it was just really hard work to listen to this as an audiobook, because some words would pop up and then, you know, I pay loads of attention. I was like, that was a new word to me. Like, should I have remembered that word? So I was constantly just, like, listening to something, and then I'd be, like, I'd get, like, 10 minutes into a chapter and just go, okay, I'm not really sure if I've caught up in everything. So then I go back and listen to it, and I go, no, I didn't miss anything. It really is just not there in the book. And then a character will show up, and you're just like, oh, is this an important character? Well, I guess this is an important character. And you can kind of tell some of the characters are important, or if they're going to be there, if they've got a French name, they could be important. And then suddenly there'll be an interlude, and it'll be like, blah, 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 blah. And it'll be like 5 minutes, or, you know, like part, like halfway through this small interlude chapter. And I was like, oh, this is happening 20 years in the past. Well, thanks for mentioning it, that, because there's no dates. It's not like, okay, in the year 2258, this is going to happen. No, nothing like that at all. Nothing like that at all. It's just like, and now this is happening. It's happening now? Well, it's happening in the third person, so it's obviously not happening to the our, you know, Jean Flambeau, so it's happening to someone else. Well, who's it happening to? Oh, it's happening here. Oh, and that's happening 20 years in the past. And you go, well, 20 years in the past means that this character is how old? Oh, and you've got to, like, piece together these things. It's like, okay, so that person, and then I was like, oh, maybe I've given away something there. But, like, all these different things where you just go and you're like, And it's clever, but then, because I was thinking so much about it and, constructing these parts of the book so much, that, in some ways, I overthought it, because then there was one of the major twists in the book, and it's a real, you know, character moment for this thing, and I was like, yeah, but I already knew that, because I'd worked out this timeline, because that flashback that happened then, that was the only reason that was there, because I knew that was going to be the thing, and we didn't... But then... I thought this was just another part of the world, or just another part of the story, which I was just being cast adrift and having to work out as a bit of a puzzle. And I didn't realise that this character revelation was going to mean so much to the character, or be, like, there'd be so much import onto it, because, again, hadn't spent enough time with this character. It was just like, oh, and this is something important, and it's totally changed his world. And it's like, yeah, but you never explained what his world was like beforehand. And so that's what I thought. I constantly thought... There was more going on in the story. And then I was thinking, well, I missed something. And then all the stuff that I was confused about. So, like, the story itself was either too simple or not simple enough or too confusing or not confusing enough. Because, you know, anyway, yeah, I made a note here. There was never any time that we slowed down. So, like, normally in a book, you'd have action, action, action. Okay, now I'm going to do some slowing down. We're going to have some character moments and we're going to have some sightseeing. It's still going to be, you know, we're going to be progressing the plot, but it's only going to be progressing slowly, a bit like that. Whereas in Hanu Ranenami, can't remember his name now, he has written it so it's just like, and now we've got over that bit of plot, and now directly onto the new plot. I'm not going to explain anything. Just go move on, move on, move on, sorry. And it is all intentional. It must be intentional, but it is, yeah, it is tricky. And I think it does, like I say, make the book worse. And I don't think I needed more time to understand what was going on, even though I did have to skip back a few times. I think I got what was going on, but like I say, the more time I could spend with the characters and with the world, I'd be more invested in them. And I'd be able to find out what they find important. And then when that important thing changes or is taken away or explodes, I kind of care a bit more. It always felt like the image that I had in my mind, it's like I was looking through, not a telescope, but like a tube, like the inside of a toilet tube, but like a long one, like the kitchen roll tube. And I was looking at the world and I was always being forced to look at the action. And there was this whole other world going on. And when a character stepped out of that toilet tube view, they'd be doing interesting stuff or stuff that I would like to know about them. But I never got that glimpse into their lives. And in the end, I felt like, I was thinking, well, is it my job? Is it really my job? Shouldn't it be the author's job to, like, tell me what's going on when a character steps off stage and then steps back on again? Shouldn't he mention where he's been? Shouldn't he mention what's going on or what he's thinking or what he's looking at or, you know, any feelings going on there at all? Or, you know, when he describes something, or he doesn't describe something, he just says, and this is called a Gavrilot and blah, blah, blah. And he just moves on with how the Gavrilot involves the plot or the characters in the story, but not actually describing what it is. And I'm thinking, well, do I have to imagine what that looks like? Do I have to imagine what it feels like to use one of these things? Do I have to imagine what it looks like or is or anything like that? And so for a lot of the time, I was like going, well, okay, this character, I've not been told this character's history, so I reckon his history is something like this. Or this place, I've not really been described its history to me, so I'm guessing it'll be a bit like this. And, you know, or what does this look? Well, I guess it'll look a bit like that. And then later on in the book, the author suddenly decides, hey, this person does have a history, and it's like this. And I'm thinking, yeah, but that's different from the one that I imagined. But the one that I imagined, because you didn't correct me ages ago, that's more important to the one I've spent more time with the facts and the descriptions and the history of the characters and all these other things. I've had more time in my brain with the thing that I've been thinking of. And now you're telling me that I'm wrong and it's actually this, but then that's wrong as well. And it's actually that. And I don't, but you didn't, like, I had a perfectly good image in my mind of what this character looked like for the last 10 chapters. And now 10 chapters later, you're saying, ah, actually he looks like this. And it's important because of this. And I'm like, it kind of clashes. I kind of felt a bit resentful that he, in some cases, finally gets around to describing something in enough detail, which has already been clear to me in my brain because I have an imagination and he's not provided enough for me to shape that imagination. So I've gone off in the other way. It's like, and all this time, he was driving a sports car, not a Ford Model T. And I'm like, oh, the Ford Model T, that had a lot more character than this boring sports car. Again, just a off the top of my head example. And again, there's this weird viewpoint thing as well. A lot of the stuff happens in the first person, and then I'm distracted and distanced from it because the first person doesn't know who he is. He doesn't remember much about him, and I'm never really sure if I can trust his memories, and he can't trust his memories, so I'm distanced there. And then other characters who do know about themselves and do trust their memories and do have strong histories, they're all in the third person, so we never really get inside their brains as much as we could. Although there is some really nice writing, you know, it's very clever. And the way that the viewpoints switch between is sometimes a bit clumsy, but often, you know, works really well in the story. What else do I have here? This writing approach and being thrown in at the deep end. Because that's... Oh, let me just quickly take a drink. I'm rambling and I realise I've still got quite a lot to go in this with some notes here about the audiobook production. So the writing approach where you just get thrown in the deep end and you've got to just imagine stuff which is going on. I've had similar problems with this as well. You know, doing an audiobook and you're like, well, did I miss something? I'm not really sure. And then I had this with The Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny. And it actually says here, it's strange because here on the Wikipedia page, it says, let me bring it up here. It says, Ray and Naomi mentioned Roger Zelazny as a strong influence. And yes, it does feel like that, you know, like these godlike powers coming in and the minions around and all that kind of stuff, a bit like Lord of Light. And with, like, yeah, don't want to go too much in there. But that was a book that I started listening as an audiobook, and it's told out of sequence and lots of stuff's going on and people are moving around and being reincarnated and going, you know, going back in and out of things. And so I started that as an audiobook and then switched across to a paper book. And to be honest, I probably should have done that here with The Quantum Thief. I think I'd have enjoyed it a lot more in that way. But there's another book which, there's quite a few other books where you just get thrown in the deep end. And one which comes to mind is the Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun. And that was, but it's a different kind of throwing in at the deep end, because in that book, nothing is explained to us as the reader. It's not like, okay, here you are in the 20th century or the 21st century, and you need a handle on the current world. I'm going to explain it to you so you in the 21st century reading it will be able to understand what's going on. I'll give you the history up until this point and I'll describe everything. There's none of that. Everything is just like the words that are being used aren't, you know, words that might mean something in English but are so obscure. But lots of other words are just invented and they're just used in context. But along with all of that is very slow character moments, too slow in fact, but also lots of really great descriptions of what stuff looks like, to the point where you understand the history of the objects by the descriptions of them. For example, they say, oh, we're in this tower, it's a metal tower, and there's this frame next to this metal tower, and there's a big thing, and there's a big hollow metal tube which is pointing up at the sky, and there's another one over here, and down below is this, and you're going, oh, so they live on spaceships, it's an old spaceship center, and there's a wall around it, and this, and they go into this hall, and there's this big mural on the hall, and it's a guy with this round hat, and it's in the middle of a grey desert with a black sky behind, but it's lit up, and he's holding a flag, and the flag has got stripes in it, and you're like, oh, that's a picture of Buzz Aldrin on the moon taken by Neil Armstrong, and I've talked to other people who didn't get that imagery and didn't realize that, oh, this is a spaceport set in the far future, but the person who lives there doesn't know it's a spaceport yet, but he will do in the future. But like I say, there's enough there to give me a real connection to the place, even though I'm being thrown in at the deep end, and even though there's so many words and stuff going on and weird memory stuff and it's all being confusing and things. So I don't mind being thrown in at the deep end, but it really, again, it just comes to that point. I think my notes here are, it doesn't work. So I should have, in that case, actually, with the Book of the New Sun, I actually switched to the audiobook, but it was Jonathan Davis narrating. So what I want to talk about thematically here, and bring it back to the Book of the New Sun and Joyland, there's a great line in Joyland where they're saying, when it comes to the past, everyone writes fiction. You know, when you understand that when you're thinking back over stuff, your memory isn't going to be correct. You're going to be making stuff in your head. You're going to have, like, you're looking through the rose-tinted glasses. You're going to make up new stuff that didn't happen, or remember stuff out of order, or think things were important at the time when they might not have been important. And, of course, in the Book of the New Sun, it's like, yes, my memory is infallible. That's what I have, and I'm writing down exactly what happened because I remember every single thing that's ever happened to me. And then you're like, really? Do you really remember that? Which brings me back to the idea that's in the Quantum Thief about the co-memory, the shared memory, the exo-memory. So you remember something and then you pass it over to somebody. And I mentioned this before, I think it was in my notes anyway. So you if something writes, like, you don't need to write something down to tell someone. You don't even need to tell them. You just open up, you pass them the key, and they remember it as they remember it. And what the Book of the New Sun recognizes, and what Joyland recognizes, or, you know, these authors, Stephen King and Gene Wolfe, realize, is that books are co-memories. Books are shared memories. They are exo-memories. I don't have to live those things, but I can remember them. All fiction is, like, when it comes to the past, everyone writes fiction. But the point is, if the past is fiction, fiction is the past. Fiction can be your fictional past. It's the author's job to make us remember what happened in the book as though it was our own memory. And that's what a co-memory is. That's what an exo-memory is. That's what fiction is. It is, you know, it is mind control. It is memory transfer. That is what fiction is. And if it has to be a co-memory, like if something is to be a co-memory, we have to be able to imagine it happening to us, or we have to know what it feels like to be there. Even if it's fiction, it has to be shared with us as though it was real. So in Joyland, that's why we got like pages and pages and pages of like hours and hours of him talking about what it was like to get over his girlfriend breaking up with him. Because in that way, it feels as though we have been in that relationship. When he goes and he works and does this and he plays with these kids and does this and he flies a kite, we, even if I've not flown a kite in a beach on, you know, the North Carolina shore, on the sea there, I can now close my eyes and remember doing that. It's fiction because it's in my past, and when it comes to the past, everyone writes fiction. But I can close my eyes and kind of think of that. Unfortunately, in The Quantum Thief, the book revolves around memories, and some memories being real, and some memories being fake, and some memories being hidden, and some memories not being hidden. But it's a book about the recovery of memory. It's a book about sharing memory. It's a book about somebody has a memory, and I need that memory. And yet, it's not written as though... Oh, but let me put it this way. Never once are we actually shown a memory in a way that is real to us. So when it says, oh, this person is a fake memory, but I was just like, but you've not made me remember anything. You've not instilled any memories in my mind so far that when I think of them, it feels real to me. But yet the book is about memories and fake memories. And I didn't know the difference in the book if something was meant to be a real memory, that like a character was remembering something and it's meant to be real, or if something's happening to them and it's not real, or if it happened to them in their past, or it happened to somebody else in their past. And again, this is part of what the book is about, so I understand that, but it feels like so much that he's missed a trick. He didn't understand what one of the main functions of fiction is, and that is creating memories. And it's a book about memories, and it's a book about co-memories and exo-memories and shared memories and passing memories around and locking memories and discovering memories and finding out what is fiction and what isn't fiction within those memories. Yeah, and so I just thought it was a very strange exercise reading through this, and again, listening to the Joyland audiobook afterwards really confirmed it in my mind. What I love about fiction is that I can close my eyes and I can remember it. In all the best books, you know, I can close my eyes and I'm there with the character. I remember what it looked like. I remember what it did. But because this book just throws you in so much at the deep end, I'm closing my eyes and I'm picturing the clocks from the movie In Time. I'm closing my eyes and picturing the people from the City and the Stars. I'm closing my eyes and I'm seeing the spaceships from the Culture. I'm closing my eyes and I'm, you know, imagining the battles in say a Peter F. Hamilton book. Every time, you know, closing my eyes and I'm seeing John Carter of Mars, the movie. And it's like, well, if I'm closing my eyes and seeing that, like, really, you should be doing better as an author, because every time I close my eyes, I'm having to like connect together with my own imagination and from other books, constructing what the memories of this place or what the views of this place could actually be like. It's not like that all the way through, but it seemed like it was a bit too much there. Anyway, it seems like I've been ragging on this book quite a lot. But there's a lot of stuff to enjoy. I actually quite like, again, it's this weird thing that even though I'm complaining about it and I think he missed a trick and I wish the book had been slower, I actually quite like the getting to the bottom of this thing and kind of working out what stuff is. And I like the thought experiment nature of this book, where stuff is just presented to you and you've got to kind of link it together all in your own brain. As a novel, I would probably have to give it about 3.5 stars, I would say. In my head, though, I've got to separate this from the audiobook, because the audiobook really did spoil my enjoyment, a lot of the enjoyment in this. And it's this weird thing, because I want to, you know, I always try and rate these books subjectively. So, you know, if this is this, but this has happened to me a few times in the past where the audiobook, the narration is so bad that I'm thinking, well, how much easier would this book have been to read or listen to if it had been a good narration, or how much more would I have enjoyed this if I'd have just read this as a paper book or as an ebook? Excuse me, I'm just going to take a quick drink again. So at this point, when I'm talking about the audiobooks, normally I do a recommendation. I say, yeah, if you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, you can get a free trial. And normally I recommend the book. Yeah, you should go and read this book or read that. But I have to say, do not get out Quantum Thief. Do not get Quantum Thief as an audiobook from Audible. It's really, really, really bad. I don't want to get too much into the reasons, but I'm going to say, if you do want a free trial from audible.com, you can check out, you know, Joyland by Stephen King. That's a really good book, really, really good book. And it's quite short as well. It's like a perfect audiobook. The narrator is really great. So I'd recommend that. And by getting a free trial, it's free for a month or 14 days. I'm not sure what the offers are at the moment, but that's certainly enough time to listen to an audiobook and decide if you want to keep going and keep paying for credits. I get 2 credits a month, which is the Platinum plan. You can also do a Gold plan, which is you get 1 book credit each month. For me, the Platinum plan is by far the best deal. But in doing so, you do actually support me and the SFBRP and the bandwidth and my own audiobooks and other reading stuff and other books that I buy. It's a great way to support this podcast. If you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, that's great. Actually, I will talk about why this book is bad. I might as well. Just to warn you off. So it's narrated by Rupert Deggers, except that when he says his name at the beginning, he mumbles so much, it's like, narrated by Rupert Deggers. I was like, who? Rupert Deggers. And I was thinking, well, that's a bit mumbly. I hope it's not like this all the way through. And then he starts off, and it's like, and sometimes he's not mumbling, and sometimes he's mumbling. I was like, why all the mumbling? Why do you have to mumble? Why couldn't you even tell? And I was thinking, well, what else did he do? I recognized the name, and I looked it up, and he did the audiobooks of Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear. So I've listened to this guy for like 80 hours in the past, because those are long books, and he's done that, and I can't remember having any complaints about the narration. He seemed like he was doing well. So I think it was the producer was saying, oh, in this case, I want you to be a gentleman and be a gentleman thief. And what does a gentleman thief sound like? Well, gentleman thief will probably mumble a bit of any. I was like, oh, okay, we got some mumbling. And then there was some music underneath part of it. And I was like, okay, great. Some guy mumbling under some music. Then the mumbling got a bit better. But then it started, suddenly reverb would be on the voice. And then halfway through a sentence, there'd be reverb on the voice. And I was like, well, what's going on with reverb on the voice? There's something talking about this. And I realized, okay, so I guess they're reading something, and it's the, you know, there's some kind of memory going on here. You can see that there's some memories, and he's remembering part of it, and maybe somebody else is remembering, and you're seeing stuff from two different sides of the same memory, and on one part of it. So I'm guessing part of it's in italics, so the part that's in italics is they put some reverb on the voice. And I was like, don't just put reverb on the voice. Why does everything have to be reverb? And then it's suddenly quite halfway through the sentence, and there's a reverb on this voice. And then back into, and yeah, that was really, really difficult. And then, but that's in the introduction. That's in the introduction, the prologue, the whatever it is at the beginning, chapter one. And suddenly, I just thought, this is really difficult. So the first time I listened to it was in bed, and I was just like, I can't deal with this. I need to. This is going to send me to sleep straight away. And I didn't want to fall asleep. And so I was like, okay, let's get on with this. Then there's a bit more music, and I saw a bit going. And then what happens is, every time Pahonan, which is the ship, speaks, she speaks directly into the minds of the people. And when she speaks, the volume goes really quiet, and you can't even hear what she's saying, because when she, and there's a reverb in the voice. When I'm talking, it's so quiet that you can't actually hear anything you're saying. And I'm like, wait a second, she's like the ship Pahonan is like a main character, and whenever she says anything, I literally just couldn't hear. And I was laying in bed, and all of the other voices were the same. And then Pahonan would talk, and she would talk into someone's voice,
and you can't hear anything I say.
And if you're actually wanting to hear what I'm saying there, it's really tricky. So every time I was doing stuff, I would have, like, the spaceship would say a line, and I was like, oh, fuck. The spaceship said something. And the spaceship was actually a really interesting character. And Pahonan would say something, and every single time, she would tell me something. What I have to do is, I'd have to get out my phone, press pause, you know, I'll press pause in the remote control on my phone, which is the little thing on the headphone, get my phone out, open up the you know, the music player, the thing, click back 15 seconds, back 15 seconds, then press play, then turn it up full blast so the normal narration is hurting my ears because it's so loud, and then when Pahonan comes in, I can finally hear her, but then when the other character comes in, it comes in really loud, and then I sort of turn it down again, and then I think, oh, thank fuck for that, well, I hope the spaceship doesn't speak again. And then she does, and it's really, really quiet, and really, really quiet, and with reverb on it to make it really difficult to understand. And then they come back in, so then I have to go out, take my phone out, rewind back. But I can't always do that. At one point, I was driving somewhere, and it happened, and I was just like, well, I hope the spaceship didn't say anything important, because there's literally no way for me to, like, reach over, get out my phone, do that, because I'm driving, I can do it. And when I'm on a bike and I'm going along, I'm just like, well, hope the spaceship isn't saying anything important. And the thing is, the spaceship probably is saying something important, because the way it's written, there's no like, and she said this and this was important, and keep track of this. It's just, oh, if it goes past, that's it. And then, just when you think it can't get any worse, then a character turns up, and this character says, and they said in the book, it's actually written, and there was like a chorus voice, like a chorus of people were speaking at the same time, and the person speaks like this. And what's going on? And I speak like this. Why do you want to talk? And I mean, this is very important. Come on, it's really great. It's really important. I don't know what it is. But they're talking, and I'm like, that could be. This is an important character, right? Don't you think the most important thing for an audiobook thing would not be to layer massive amounts of effects on a character who could be really important when they're saying something? It could be important for me to understand them. No, I don't want to understand what's going on because they're speaking like this.
And then the spaceship comes up,
and then it goes back to the normal mumbly voice, and I'm Jean Le Flambert. And then the other characters, and I was just like, this is like, why are you putting voice effects? Why put voice effects on everything? It's just like. And of course, I understand because some of the characters turn out to be the same character, you know, because they, like, they either don't remember who they are, or there's, I don't want to give it away, but I understand, they had to put a different character voice on this, and even in the book, because this character isn't meant to recognize who this other character is, because, you know, with the Gavulot, you don't see who it is, you can just hear it, and you can do stuff anonymously. So it's understandable that the voice is in disguise, but you'd think that, and I was just like, fuck this audiobook all the time. I was just like, I'm enjoying the story. And just as I was getting into the story, suddenly the spaceship was saying, I want anybody who has anything in the spaceship saying, because there's no one who's saying anything. So I'm enjoying this. And then at the end of the book, it's like, and it goes, narrated by Rupert Degas. And then, I can't see it. I thought I made a note of the guy, oh yeah, someone Perry or something, Peter Rinney, music, recording, and production by Peter Rinney. I made a note of that. Well, Peter Rinney, here's a bit of advice. The most important thing in an audiobook is that I can hear the words. That's the most important thing. But it's literally like reading a book, and then, like, at this one part of the book, you've got to, you know, they've just printed it in white ink, and you're like, oh, fuck it, I hate the part of the book where they write in white ink. So you've got to get the book out and turn it on, you know, and then you get out your UV light and you shine the UV light on, or like blast the light down, and get out your microscope or get out your magnifying glass and look through and look at the clues, and then you keep pages. It's like, oh, and this whole part of the book is written in invisible ink. It's like, oh, fuck it. So then you've got to go and get the lemon, or you've got to piss on the page, and the, you know, the acidity or whatever it is makes it and turns it brown, and you're like, oh, thankfully. Or you get a candle and put the candle. It's like that. And I don't want my books to be like that. I just want to be able to listen to the books and it to be a pleasure. I want to just listen. Anyway, that's it from me. End with a complaint. Audibletrial.com, SFBRP. Don't get this book. Just get the ebook. You'll probably enjoy it. And that's my only recommendation. Anyway, that's it from me. Thanks a lot. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. You can check out my own fiction at my website, lukeburge.com. You can contact me on goodreads.com and join the SFPRP listener group there. And also, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. The next episode will probably be a Philip K. Dick book. Otherwise, that's it from me, and I'll catch you next time.